Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. We have a number of items that are on our agenda today. Let me go through the work session stuff because some of the stuff is not ready or has been requested by leadership to wait until there's more discussion. So House Bill 4026A, House Bill 4035A, and House Bill 4068A. All of those are scheduled for work session today. They will, in fact, be carried over until next Tuesday, which is our last day. So again, if you're here for work sessions on 4026A, 4035A, and 4068A, and if you want to track these bills, come see us on Tuesday. With that, what we're going to do is we have one other bill that we will be moving out on that's scheduled for work session, House Bill 4114A. And then for public hearings, as you can see, we have at this point three bills, House Bill 4037, House Bill 4103A, and 4143A. We will be taking testimony on all of those bills. Do not know whether they will be worked in work session today. More than likely, they will not, but no guarantee they could be worked. And then I have various...
As long as you've got a plan, that's important.
I have various members that are here that have other obligations. So what we are going to do is start off with House Bill 4103A. So I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on 4103A. Shannon?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 4103A comes here at the request of the House Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency. The bill requires lien claimants, when providing notice of foreclosure sale, to provide lien debtor and persons with security interest copies of records and documents that are evidence of the basis of the lien when the chattel, a motor vehicle, boat, or aircraft provides a failure to give lien with security interest notice foreclosure is an unlawful trade practice. Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
All right, thank you. So what I'm going to do is Representative Hovey, Scoggins, Pam Levitt, and Tom Gallagher. Why don't we bring up that fourth chair? We'll just get everyone on this panel done. While they're coming up and getting set up, the plan at this point, after taking the public hearing on this bill, I'm not sure if we have everything ready to move it or not, but we will be taking the testimony on 4037, and then we'll conclude with 4143, since we have a number of people. I do have a couple of representatives that are here in the room. If they cannot wait to do the testimony then, we'll take theirs out of order. All right. Representative, if you want to get started. And Tom, I'm having you come on up as well.
Chair Przanski, members of the Judiciary Committee, thank you very much for allowing me to go first so I can get on with some other things. I will just a little bit of brief background. I was contacted by On Point Credit Union and with this issue about possessory liens and their interest in automobiles and not being able to protect their interest in the case of the foreclosure sale of the automobiles generally, whether it's a tower's lien or a mechanic's lien. Looked into this a little bit, and we proposed the original bill looked at making sure that the liens were essentially proven, that there was evidence that the liens were substantiated and were reasonable. We had a lot of discussions, stakeholder meetings with the towers and automobile dealers, the credit unions, and a few others. That piece of the bill has been taken out, and we're now just focusing on the remaining piece, which was to ensure that notification was actually made, and if in fact the notification to the lien holders and the owners was not made, that there was a remedy for the owner and the lien interest holders to protect, you know, their interest in the automobile. And one of the reasons that this system doesn't work right now is that there's really no way to pay for your attorney fees to challenge this, and because the attorney fees oftentimes would be more than the automobile is worth. The current draft you have in front of you does place this under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. The committee felt that it was important to be in there on the House side. in case we have some bad actors that keep continually doing this, that the Attorney General would have a standing to do something about it. However, I think the credit unions and Mr. Gallagher have come to an agreement to just provide the attorney fee provisions under 87.196, I believe, to go that route. The bill does a few other things. We don't want to, very rarely does a security interest holder go after the buyer of the automobile at the foreclosure sale. It's just not, you know, they had no way to know that there was an existing lien on it and felt that, you know, that just isn't kosher. And so they decided that we would change that aspect of the law, too. So I appreciate Mr. Gallagher and the credit unions coming to an agreement on this piece of the bill, and I think we will probably continue to talk about some other pieces during the interim about making sure the lien is substantial, or the lien is valid and based on, you know, good documentation. But that piece of the bill, I think, will take more conversation in the future. But I commend the parties for coming to an agreement, at least on this piece, to allow credit unions the opportunity to protect their interest and the consumer's interest. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Pam, are you?
Just briefly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Pam Levitt with the Northwest Credit Union Association. I provided you with some written testimony, and I really call to your attention the testimony from On Point Community Credit Union that really outlines what they've seen with some of these mechanical liens, and it's certainly an example of a story that has happened in several of our credit unions where our members have lost their vehicles. And I wanted to thank Representative Holvey for bringing this before the legislature, and I will let our attorney, Hal Scoggins, speak a little bit more. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Hal Scoggins. I'm an attorney representing the Northwest Credit Union Association, as well as numerous credit unions throughout Oregon. And our goal in this process was really to have three things come out of it. One would be that the lien claimant, whether it's towing, storage, mechanic, whatever it is, provide as part of the lien notice of the foreclosure sale that they provide a detail as to what the charges are that support the lien that's being foreclosed, so that we have some basis of knowing whether it's valid or not, whether it should be objected to or not. The second would be that we have a claim against the lien claimant that sells the vehicle at the foreclosure sale if they haven't complied with the procedure under the statute, which we currently don't have now. As Representative Holvey outlined, we have a claim against the buyer of the car, which is often not a good way to proceed, either for public policy or for public relations or for many other reasons. And then the last thing is we also wanted, as part of that claim against the lien claimant who does a foreclosure sale out of compliance, that we also be entitled to recover attorney's fees. That enhances the viability of those claims and also enhances incentives to do it right.
All right. Thank you, Tom.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom Gallagher representing the new car dealers. I agree with everything that's been said. I'm just here to answer questions and say I support the amendment.
All right. Thank you. Senator Roblin first.
So it sounds like you've come to an agreement. Do we have that agreement in the bill now, or is there
a dash?
Is there
an amendment
that's coming that hasn't been done yet?
I was trying to see it.
That's what I was getting confused.
That's what I was asking counsel if we had everything. My understanding is the amendment is in the works. It's been put in there. We're waiting for that to come back.
Okay.
We will not be able to work the bill today, but if you have any questions, this is the time to ask. It sounds to me like we have one of those good standard
kumbaya.
And we like that
process. Session bill. That's good.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So,
Mr. Chair, if I might, I just want to make a comment that, you know, there's a lot of good businesses and companies and individuals in this business, and we're very cognizant that we didn't want to cast a black shadow over the industry. This is just a few bad actors occasionally that we just don't have the ability to do anything about right now. And so I appreciate, I don't make a lot of compromises, but I'm learning after 10 years that, you know, sometimes I got to listen to people.
Give and take?
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate that you're learning that. As my representative, I really
appreciate
you continue doing that. I do want to thank all of you for the work that you've done, because, I mean, this is the reality that you do, in fact, have unfortunate individuals, businesses, or organizations that seem to cloud everybody, and that's not who we're, I mean, those are the individuals we're trying to, let's say, get behavior modification as compared to everyone else, and I think this will be good for everyone within the industry. So thank you very much. All right. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony in 4103A? Not seeing it. We'll close that public hearing. And we're going to carry that bill over for Tuesday of next week with the paperwork that we should be having, just to make certain we're dotting the I's and crossing the T's. With that, we're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing on House Bill 4037. And so
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4037 comes to you from Representative Barton, authorizes County Sheriff to designate either County Juvenile Department or Oregon Youth Authority for transportation, transporting youth offenders directly to the youth corrections facility. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this comes into play when you have a youth who's been convicted in adult court, and they are legally in the legal custody of the Department of Corrections, but physical custody of the Youth Authority. So they would go directly to the Youth Authority. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have the Dash 1 amendments. They have been withdrawn by the proponent of the amendments. And so the bill stands as originally written, and we have all the paperwork on that.
Okay.
So we have the fiscal revenue.
All right. So why don't we go ahead? I have three individuals that look like they have signed up to give testimony on this bill. Marie Garcia, Christina McManahan, and Shannon White. Once you three come forward, while they're coming up, is there anyone else who thinks they're going to be wanting to testify on House Bill 4037? Okay.
There's a fourth chair.
Yeah, and if there's a fourth chair, let me do this. We'll get... Thank you very much. And then, since we don't have your name on the roster, if you could just tell us who you are.
Certainly. I'm Christine Kirk with the Oregon Youth Authority.
Kirk?
Kirk, K-I-R-K. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Who would like to start?
I'm going to start.
Shannon?
Good morning, Chair Prozanski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Shannon White. I'm the Deputy Director with Partnership for Safety and Justice, and we are here today in support of House Bill 4037. The bill is fairly straightforward in that it just allows a sheriff, a local sheriff, to designate either the Oregon Youth Authority or a juvenile department to transport youth directly to the Oregon Youth Authority. This would apply to youth who otherwise would go through adult intake at Coffee Creek because they've been convicted as an adult, usually under Measure 11. And we have worked with all the stakeholders who you will hear from today, although the sheriffs are not here, but I think you do have their written testimony in support of the bill, to work out this agreement so these youth will no longer be have to go through the adult intake at Coffee Creek. What we know is that youth who have contact with the adult system are more likely to recidivate and commit future crimes, and we also know that they are often put at risk. When youth were held in the Coffee Creek facility, they're often put in isolation for their own physical protection, which can aggravate existing mental health problems and lead to suicidal thoughts and actual suicide, which happened recently at Coffee Creek. So we are very excited to be here in support of this bill, and thankful that all the stakeholders have worked so hard to find a resolution so that we actually can implement this idea that's actually been bubbling around in the legislature and was passed initially last session with House Bill 3183, that we actually have now the process to implement what we know works best for youth. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Who'd like to go next?
Good morning, Chair Prozanski, members of the committee. My name is Christina McMahon. I'm the Juvenile Division Director from Multnomah County, and I'm also here representing the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association. We echo what Ms. White just said. We, our association and Multnomah County, are both in support of this legislation. In Multnomah County, we made a policy decision several years ago to house all of our juvenile offenders in our juvenile detention center, and we did that because, in keeping with the policy choice that the state of Oregon had made to commit Measure 11 or adult charged youth in youth correctional facilities with the Oregon Youth Authority, we mirrored that in Multnomah County because we know that, as Ms. White said, kids are different. There are adolescent development issues. We have staff that are trained and have experience working with those issues, just as the Oregon Youth Authority does. And we feel it's in the best interests of the youth and our organizations to make sure that their transitions are more successful. So as Ms. White alluded to, they have a lot of, most of the kids that we deal with have pretty significant mental health issues. Many have been, had pretty significant trauma in their early childhood and throughout their life. Everyone who works in our field knows that there are, the more transitions kids have, the more trauma triggers they end up having, and that really contributes to a lack of success when they end up in the Oregon Youth Correctional Facility, because sometimes they've gone from a juvenile detention facility to the sheriff's jail after they've been convicted, then to Coffee Creek, and then to Oregon Youth Authority. So it's a lot of change in a very short amount of time. We believe that Ms. White said the sheriff has the ability to designate. I just wanted to clarify that it is really about collaboration. It's permissive. Mm-hmm. The Oregon Juvenile Directors Association was in support of this because it would not disrupt existing arrangements in communities. Some of the smaller communities partner with the Oregon Youth Authority to be able to do transports. We partner with our sheriff's office. So we were in favor of this because it doesn't disrupt any of the things that are working around the state, and it isn't a mandate. So we would ask that you support this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Prozonsky and members of the committee, I am Marie Garcia, Legislative and Government Relations Manager for the Oregon Department of Corrections. And on behalf of the department, I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 4037. We do feel that the bill is for the greater good of juvenile offenders. I won't repeat what the bill does, but we do feel that there are great benefits of the bill. And the bill expands on previous statutory amendments, which would help to facilitate sound correctional practices by allowing the direct transport of juvenile offenders to Oregon Youth Authority.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Prozanski and committee members. My name is Christine Kirk, and I'm the Governmental Relations Manager for the Oregon Youth Authority. I'm here on behalf of the director, as well as Philip Cox, whom you have testimony for within for the measure, to voice our support for this. I would like to thank the partnership for working through how this can best operationally work, as well as in terms of what legislation is needed. The only thing I would like to add is that one of the things that this does is it reinforces the relationship that OIA has with the counties in terms of our responsibility to work on that transition of youth from the county to the state. And we have a responsibility to work together to know that youth, to understand the issues that they have, and this reinforces that point of accountability and that we need to have that effective relationship in bringing youth to the Oregon Youth Authority. Thank you very much for your consideration.
All right, thank you. Questions? Let me ask a couple. My understanding is that there was a proposed amendment. We just want to put this on the record. Whoever was the proponent of that amendment, I don't know if you're at the table or not, but that is not moving forward?
No, not by anyone at this table, for sure. And I have word from Mr. Mason that amendment is not moving forward.
All right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that amendment came to us from Senator Ferrioli's office. It involved the transfer of youth from Wasco and another county to the tribal courts in Warm Springs. Senator Ferrioli's staff came to our office just before the meeting and said they'd like to withdraw the amendment. They'd like time to work on some details, and they have it ready for the 2015 session.
Okay, I just want to make sure we got everything on the record. All right, the other thing is, it's kind of interesting because there is this requirement where you have a juvenile who has to be isolated or separated from adults. Understand that under the process, if they're
remanded for trial as an adult. I guess at that point they become adults, even though they may not be. And so what this bill will actually do is help with that transition. So instead of putting them directly for intake into Coffee Creek for processing as an adult, they would be, on a discretionary basis, would be going to OYA for that processing. Is that correct?
Chair Pozanski, for the record, yes, that is correct. And the policy in Oregon right now is that those youth are serving their sentence at the Oregon Youth Authority anyway, while under the law they could, in theory, do it at the Department of Corrections, but Oregon has made a very smart choice a long time ago that we weren't going to do that to kids because we get better outcomes when they have juvenile-specific services. So this was really kind of a glitch in our overall plan that was identified by some of our members who had kids going through it, and everyone has always wanted to make the change, and now we finally have the opportunity to do it with all the partners at the table.
All right, great. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much for coming forward. And at this point, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 4037. And my understanding, the bill is ready. We have all the paperwork that we need. So we'll open up a work session on House Bill 4037.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4037 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 4037 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And the chair will carry 4037 to the floor, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 4037. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and go and take care of one other work session that we said that we had the paperwork on, which is House Bill 4114A. I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on that bill. Shamit, is that yours?
Chair Pozanski, it is my bill. As you'll recall, this authorizes the courts to create a protected person special advocate program and to appoint qualified volunteers to serve as those advocates. You have the -A4 amendments, which exclude financial institutions and trust companies who are working as fiduciaries from this bill.
All right, and so at this point, we need the A4s to be adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the A4 amendment to House Bill 4114.
Senator Cruz moves the adoption of the -4 A4s into House Bill 4114A. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Chair, I move House Bill 4114A as amended by the -A4 amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz now moves House Bill 4114A as amended by the A4s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dimbro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I mentioned at the end of the public hearing, I'm really delighted to see us move forward with this bill. I think this session, even though it's a short session, we are going to be, at the end of the day, doing some really good things in getting out in front of what my good friend likes to call the silver tsunami, you know, the issue of how to deal with seniors who find themselves in very vulnerable positions and supporting their families. And I think the CASA model is a very successful one. It really calls on the best instincts of Oregonians to help other members of their community, and I think it's a great thing that we're passing it.
All right, thank you. Any other comments or questions? Any objection to the motion that's before us? Not seeing any, so ordered. And do we have anyone who'd like to carry this one to the floor?
I think because Senator Dembro had a significant bill on the health care committee dealing with the silver tsunami, which is maybe one of the best bills we've done this session, that it would be appropriate for him to carry this one as well.
I think that's a good suggestion, and I don't think the good senator has carried a bill for the Senate, and I'm not sure if he's actually had one on the floor yet. So, Senator Dimbro, you will be our carrier on House Bill 4114A.
Ooh.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
let's just hope this is not the beginning of the Dimbro tsunami. Thank you.
All right. So, folks, what we're going to do now, we have about an hour and a half left in our time slot, and we're going to be taking testimony on House Bill 4143A. So what I'd like to do is we have a number of individuals who want to testify. We have panels. We're going to start with the first panel is going to be Representative Reed and Representative Williamson. Let me first open up the public hearing on House Bill 4143A. And I'm going to, we want an overview of the complete bill. I will tell everyone, one of the things I want people to be focusing on at some level is the position as to whether or not the changes not on the CyPRE portion of the bill, but does this actually change somehow how the class is defined and how it's organized and qualified, et cetera. So I know that each of the different individuals that will be giving testimony are going to be testifying about specifics portions, but I think based on my conversations with individuals on this committee, that will help focus members as to some of the concerns that have been raised as to the process and procedure that would be adopted through this adoption of the bill. With that.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. Thank you for the invitation, and thank you for letting us speak. We're here to introduce House Bill 4143, which comes to you on a bipartisan vote from the House. It is not a new concept. It has been introduced time and time again in this body over the last couple of decades, and in some form or another, it is the law of the land in 48 other states. I'm going to leave it to the lawyers who will follow me, including the Attorney General, to take on the technical questions. The closest I came was the honor of serving in the House Judiciary Committee in 2007 when there were only four lawyers in the whole House. So I don't want to get too far in that direction.
That's three more than we have on our side.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I do think is worth remembering is that the principle of CPRE is to find a purpose as near as possible to the original purpose. And in this bill, we are directing unclaimed funds and class actions to legal aid. You have in OLIS a letter from the Coalition Against Domestic Violence that describes the good work that they do and the need, and we think that's a very appropriate place for these unclaimed funds to go. What's really important, as you hear a lot of other testimony to follow us, is to keep in mind that this is a very simple concept. While the words are specific, the concept is simple. And imagine a burglar who manages to steal televisions from 50 victims. The police then catch the burglar, they recover all 50 televisions, and they're able to return televisions to 30 of the original victims. If this situation was handled as we now handle class actions in Oregon, the burglar would retain 20 televisions. And I think it's time that we hold those who have been found at fault accountable. The time is now. I appreciate your hearing the bill, and I hope you'll support it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Williamson. I represent House District 36, the west side of Portland. Thank you for hearing our bill today. As you all know, I serve as the co-chair of the Public Safety Ways and Means Committee. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about funding and where we're asking these funds to go. As with all of our great programs, severe cuts in our state budget have dramatically reduced the funding to legal aid. In 2011, all general support was general fund support was eliminated from legal aid, and now they only receive a small percentage of state court filing fees, totaling about $11.9 million per biennium. We continue to see a very similar decline, if a not steeper decline, at the federal level. And it's resulted in legal aid programs currently having a total budget of $15 million. In other words, we meet 15% of the need for legal aid in this state. I think it's up on OLIS, but I wanted to draw your attention to a letter that Governor Kulongowski and Attorney General Hardy Myers submitted. They both wanted to be here this morning but couldn't make it, so they sent in a letter. And I've given it to staff, and I don't know if it's been posted yet, but I wanted to make sure you knew that it was there. Recently, the Campaign for Equal Justice pulled together a task force to develop short and long-term goals necessary to achieve just minimally adequate legal aid funding in Oregon. I had the honor of serving on this task force and, in fact, brought the report from the task force if anyone would like to look at it. During the course of our work, we studied various concepts from every state in the nation and looked at the way that they funded their legal aid program to see what best practices were and what we should do in Oregon to increase both public and private support of legal aid. The concept in House Bill 4143 was one of the policies suggested by this work group that could increase public support of legal aid. So, as you heard from my colleague from Beaverton, instead of returning the spoils of fraud back to wrongdoers, this bill gives us a chance to invest those funds in critical legal services and ensuring that Oregonians across the state have access to equal justice under the law. As you may know, time is of the essence in this bill. That's why we're working on it in a short session. We know there are cases that will result in funding to legal aid if we pass this bill this session. This is an urgent bill, and it's a historic opportunity for us. So with my colleague from Beaverton, I urge your support.
All right, questions for the representatives? Thank you very much for being here, and thank you for participating. All right, our next panel is going to be Attorney General Rosenblum and Fred Boss. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, my name is Ellen Rosenblum. I'm the Attorney General for the state of Oregon. And I come before you today in support of House Bill 4143. With me is Fred Boss, my Deputy Attorney General. Many of us have been harmed in some way and therefore have been eligible to participate in a class action lawsuit. We may not even have known it. Most of us find out when we get a letter in the mail telling us about some award against a company with whom we've done business, a phone company or possibly an insurance company or even a video rental chain. The note tells us we're entitled to a claim, and to collect that claim as part of a class, we need to fill out the enclosed paperwork and send it all back to a class action administrator whom we've never met. Often the value of the claim is low enough that it just doesn't seem like it's worth the effort to read and fill out the paperwork. So chances are that at least a few of us have never sent that paperwork back. It's also possible the paperwork was sent to our last address or in some other way routed so that it didn't reach us. It's also the case that we would have been entitled to the paperwork if the class action administrator knew where to find us, but they didn't, so the letter never came. It's for all of these reasons and more that in many class action cases, people who have suffered damage and are entitled to compensation never write to collect their award. And this creates a leftover pot of money, which reflects the damage caused by the defendant but not able to be paid out because the participant cannot be found. In the vast majority of states, this money is subjected to a legal principle called CyPRAE. Some say CyPRAE. I haven't been able to figure out which is correct. But it means next best, which allows the unused funds to be dedicated to a charitable purpose. In a little under a dozen states, including Washington to the north, these residual damages are routed in whole or in part to legal aid. In Oregon, the money is simply returned to the defendant who caused the damage. It's time to end this practice. At its core, House Bill 4143 is a relatively simple legislative concept. It directs a judge in a class action to order undistributed damages to be deposited in an account for the purpose of funding legal aid rather than being returned to the defendant. This does require a change to ORCP 32F, which has to do with the way notice is provided to class participants of their eligibility to collect damages, and ORCP 32L, which currently requires all class members to be known and named within a judgment. Under existing law, when you receive notice, you either opt in or you opt out. There's no provision made for those many participants who can't be located or who fail to respond. The changes in House Bill 4143 are necessary to allow these damages to be recognized and equitably distributed rather than simply returned to the defendant. So that's what the changes to the current law provide for and nothing more. And that's what this bill does. I feel that it's also necessary to spend a moment and explain what the bill does not do. Prior to this hearing, we were asked to look into the constitutionality and soundness of the bill, and a similar request was made to legislative counsel. We agree that House Bill 4143 is constitutional and sound, and we submitted a floor letter to that effect to the House a couple of days ago.
I understand that there are many people who wish to speak on this issue, so I won't try to answer every legal argument, and I'm not sure I could, that has been made about this bill. But there are a few points which merit special attention, and I also have Mr. Boss with me who can follow up if there are some additional questions that that you may have. First, the bill does not expand the class. The class in a class action is comprised of all people injured by a defendant. This rule does not change that calculation. It could not change that calculation. If a tobacco company is the defendant, for example, the injured parties are smokers. This rule cannot create additional smokers. What it does is it changes how awards due to unidentified members of the class are distributed, and nothing more. Right now, a defendant in a class action can often expect that half of the class will not be located, and half of the value of the damage caused to them, therefore, returned. And when I refer to that half, I'm talking about the verdict or the settlement, the actual amount that has been determined to have that the defendant caused by way of damages. The defendant was responsible for all the damage, so this can fairly be described as a windfall to the defendant. Holding the defendant for the full amount of the damages caused does not in any way expand the class. Second, the bill does not violate the Oregon or the federal Constitution. I have read that some have concerns about violations of due process. House Bill 4143 cannot override the Constitution. A judge will still be obligated to meet all constitutional requirements and protect the due process rights of all parties. Class members will still be entitled to adequate notification, and defendants will still be entitled to defend themselves against allegations of damages. This bill is not a taking or an interference with a contract or anything similar. Many of these allegations seem to be aimed at the doctrine of cypre itself, already a common feature in almost every other state in the nation, and not to the specifics of House Bill 4143. But nonetheless, I want to be as clear as possible. This bill is constitutional. Next, this bill does not increase attorney fees. Attorney fees and all other costs are paid first out of the settlement funds or the judgment. Second, the case is usually turned over to a class action administrator to identify and pay the class members. This legislation does not impact that two-step process because these new procedures are not invoked until after the class is paid. Indeed, when this legislation kicks in, the attorney fees are paid as well, and they are long gone. Finally, this bill is not new. This was already referenced earlier by the speakers. Indeed, a bill very similar to this one was introduced by Attorney General Hardy Myers, who continues to support this legislation based on a conversation I had with him yesterday. And it has been reintroduced several times since then, most recently by former Representative Chris Garrett. I've heard the suggestion that this issue is too new, too complex, and too hurried for consideration, and that it should be left for a work group or given to the Council on Court Procedures. This is not a new song. As to the suggestion that this go to the Council on Court Procedures first for review, which, of course, is a very august group, it's our understanding that that has been done before and the Council deferred to the legislature as a policy matter. I don't know that anyone here would question that there may be no more worthy cause than legal aid. Representative Williamson has already given you a sense of the extent of the need here in Oregon and how this bill would benefit our citizens, referring to the 15%, which is unfortunately a smaller percentage than has been over the past few years. That is, we can only serve at the current time through our excellent legal aid programs here in the state, approximately 15% of those who are eligible for legal services, for free legal services. They have to meet 125% of the poverty level. Sadly, those eligible for legal services in Oregon grew by 61.5% between 2000 and 2011, the eighth largest growth in poverty in the nation. So there's no question but that there is a need, and that this would passage of this bill would go a long way to helping fill the access to justice gap that tarnishes our state and hurts our citizens who have nowhere else to turn for legal help at critical junctures in their lives. But it is also important that Oregon finally step forward, join our neighbors in taking the equitable step of not returning residual damages to the very defendant who inflicted them. It is time for Oregon to join the larger community of our sister states and to make the right decision. So I urge you to pass House Bill 4143. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Fred, were you here just for questions or do you have other comments?
Chair Brozanski, Fred Boss, Deputy Attorney General. I'm here to the best of my ability to assist the Attorney General in answering questions.
All right, thank you. Questions?
I have one. It's been referenced that there's only one other state that is under the same formula that we have. Do you know what state that is?
I believe, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, I believe that is New Hampshire.
Okay, thank you. All right, any other comments? Thank you very much for coming forward. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you,
members of the
committee.
What we're going to do is go ahead and call up our next panel. We're going to need a fourth chair. It's going to be Dave Promar, Brad Daniels, Carol Bernerkel, and J.L. Wilson. Thank you very much for being here. Former Attorney General Fromar, I assume that you're going to take the lead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Dave Frohnmeyer. I'm here representing BP America. Our law firm has on appeal an important case which may be affected by the measure that is currently before you. Our firm also represents several other clients who may be affected by this legislation on appeal. But we are not authorized to speak for or represent their position. I have not communicated with any of those other clients, and I do not know their position on this bill. So I speak solely for the client with which we have identified. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not sure that I'm leading off on this, but apparently since you recognize me, Your Honor, I will do so. Let me begin by saying what I hope didn't need saying, and that is that I'm a longtime friend of legal aid. I've made contributions both individually and through my law firm as recently as last fall. I believe in its cause. Many of the causes that it represents are constitutionally required, and it does a great service and, of course, has been traditionally underfunded. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I also want to represent to you that anything that I say today is consistent with positions I've taken in a long career of public service. And I open myself to any question of the chair or other person if you believe that there is a departure from what I represent to you from positions that have been ones of long standing. The first of them, of course, was as a state representative, part of Senator Brzezinski's present district, and in the Judiciary Committee at that time, in which we served with Governor Kulongoski and Hardy Myers, whose names have been invoked today, we long saw the fights about class actions, defendants' bar, plaintiffs' bar, issues back and forth, but also saw that there was an independent interest, which was the interest of the judiciary in fair administration of justice. And it is for that reason that we created, and I believe that then Representative Myers was a principal mover in creating the Council on Court Procedures, which over the last nearly 40 years has developed rules that are consistent, that are stable, that are predictable, and that are fair, and that balance interests. It's recognized that class action procedures are enormously complex and require the expertise of people who go far beyond the kind of knowledge that I possess. And so the remarkable stability of the rules promulgated by that body is, I think, assurance that we try to give fairness to all sides in these matters. When I had the privilege of serving in the position that General Rosenblum now occupies, we both prosecuted and defended against class actions. The state treasury is at stake in the event that class action rules are promiscuously abandoned. And so in that respect, the state needs to have a steady hand and certainty in this respect. A third role, Mr. Chairman, and I believe this recitation is necessary, at least important, was when I was asked by your colleagues to serve on the Public Commission of the Legislature. And we did recommend that annual sessions be held and that a short session be held in even-numbered years. But it was with the understanding in that recommendation that those sessions would be limited to emergency matters, to budget matters, to the kinds of adjustments that ought to be made, but that matters of deep import or complexity should be saved either for interim committees or for the regular long session. And it's in that respect, of course, that the voice of alarm has been raised by the radicalism, really, of the measure that is before you, at least in the parts that to which I will address my remarks. And finally, in my career as a law professor, I've worried about constitutional law. I've savored constitutional law. I worry about procedural fairness, the Due Process Clause of the United States, and, of course, an almost unique Oregon invention, which is the high development of state constitutional law, our right to remedy, our remedy in due course of law, the jury trial that's required. So I believe, in other words, Mr. Chairman, that there's nothing that I'm about to tell you now that it's inconsistent with this longstanding career. This measure throws a grenade into long-settled class action law. You have a distinguished letter by distinguished former predecessors of mine who said it doesn't upset law. Members of the committee, I ask you to make that judgment for yourselves. You have before you the A engrossed bill. You may start, if you wish, on page 1, line 20, in which, for some unknown reason, procedures by which people are identified are stricken. I ask you to look at page 2 in lines 1 through 5, where, with some specificity, in order to identify precisely what's at stake, class members and their interests can be assessed. That is deleted. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I ask you to look at lines 11 through 13, which give an option to people to opt out of a class. That isn't just a privilege. That isn't just a whimsy. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think you know that Oregon law guarantees every individual a remedy in due course of law. And if a person doesn't choose to be represented by a class attorney in a class action, that person retains as a property right the right to sue individually. But that person needs to know that he or she has the right. If he or she doesn't, the statute of limitations runs, or there's a lack of certainty, there's a serious risk of a taking of that right, which is violative of both Oregon and federal constitutions. Again, this language is deleted with no explanation in testimony that has been given yet this morning in this committee, or in testimony, at least as I understand it, that was given in the very brief hearing on the House side. Look, if you will, making your own judgment at lines 15 through 17. The amount of damages shall not exceed the total amount of damages to be allowed. Does deletion of this language mean that damages can be greater than they should be? Why is this language being deleted? I'm not asking, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, a rhetorical question. We do not know why this rash deletion of existing due process procedural protections has been eliminated in the A engrossed version. Lines 22 through 24 say that you need to have a claim. Has that now been eliminated? And lines 26 through 28 again present another due process issue where the present class action law gives adequate notice or protects the rights of individuals by specificity. That, too, is erased by this measure. And lines 26 through 28 limit damages. Is a limitation on damages now to be itself eliminated? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I said this is radical. I said it's a hand grenade. Maybe the metaphor is too strong, but I can't find another one, or at least I think the one I've used does justice to the degree of departure from existing law, again, without any articulated explanation by the sponsors of the bill or by any testimony of which we are aware. Look to the changes, if you will, on page 2, lines 40 through 43. A class now must only be generally described. That, to our knowledge, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is a new term. What must the judge do? Right now we know what a judge is supposed to do because the law tells him. Now the judge needs only to describe generally the class. So this means that a whole range of new court and appellate court decisions need to be made to find out what is sufficient to be, quote, a general description. Perhaps the sponsors of the bill can tell us where that language came from, what other court, what other state uses it. We're not aware that it's in the federal rules of any kind. So this is, again, a departure from what we have. And finally, Mr. Chair, in page 3, lines 6 through 8, a court gets to make a basic determination if it concludes that a practice is not, quote, practicable.
We do not know the range of discretion conferred by that language, but it surely is new language, and it surely is troubling language. And then, of course, finally, Mr. Chair, Section 5, retroactivity. There was no testimony, as I understand it, on the House side about why a measure of this magnitude should be made retroactive. As you know, constitutionally, retroactive legislation is suspect. That isn't Dave Frohnmayer speaking. That's the United States Supreme Court speaking to its distaste for laws that affect actions after they've already occurred and change the law and change the rules. There has been no testimony, no explanation, no fiscal impact, and no court impact. Does this committee know how many cases are pending in Oregon courts, what they involve, what their stage is, how many of them need to be re-noticed or perhaps even retried because this new provision is now made immediately applicable to them? If this committee has not been given that information, is it not a high risk of the public interest to assume that a retroactive law is just or is fair? So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there's much more that might be said. I have learned panelists who have actual experience in these matters, but I hope the panel will take seriously these concerns of this very suddenly introduced and promiscuously amended, if I may use that term. Actually, I'll take back that term. But amended radically at the last minute without supportive testimony that gives the public, us, or you guidance as to why those changes in our law have been made. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Who's going to go next?
Chair Przanski, committee members. I'm Brad Daniels. I'm a partner at Stoll Reeves, a Portland law firm. My practice includes litigating and settling class actions. I'm here on behalf of BP West Coast Products to testify in opposition to House Bill 4143. House Bill 4143 is not a simple bill. It overturns class action law that has been in place for 40 years. And in my comment, I'm specifically directing my attention to Section 1 of the bill that Attorney General Frohnmayer just described, the wholesale deletion of ORCP 32F, or at least significant portions of it. It does this, it makes this change, without the careful consideration and input of the Council on Court Procedures or any other working group. And I do want to address the comment with respect to the Council. The Council does have jurisdiction and carefully considers procedural rules that are reflected in Section 1 of the bill. In fact, one of the provisions at page 2, lines 8 through 14, was a provision that was added in 2006 and reflected a careful study and compromise position with respect to the claim form procedure and class action law. This bill deletes that provision as well as other provisions without the input of the Council or any similar body. This sweeping change is being put before you in a short session with minimal analysis and without any significant justification for the rush to passage. Now, that alone should give you pause, but I want to raise a few specific other problems with the bill. First, the bill significantly affects the rights of individual plaintiffs and defendants. Oregon's current law reflects a balanced approach that protects the individual rights of absent class members to decide for themselves whether to pursue compensation in a class action. A number of people wish to exercise that right. Some people don't for their own reasons, including their disagreement with the object of the lawsuit. Current law preserves each citizen's right to decide for themselves whether they feel harmed and whether they wish to pursue compensation. It also protects the rights of defendant by ensuring that the defendant will only pay valid and proven claims to class members. Under this bill, the court can eliminate those procedures if it determines that it would be simply impractical to do so. And that kind of major policy shift requires careful consideration, not a rushed passage. Significant constitutional and practical questions arise when you take a system that has been working for 40 years and replace it with nothing. Now, there is a vigorous debate over whether this type of procedure is constitutional, not only here, but in courts across the country. The current rule has the virtue of being clear and understandable. The parties and the court know what is required in a class action. House Bill 4143 essentially tells the judge, you go figure it out. You develop a process that's constitutional. You develop a procedure that's consistent with the party's rights. Now, I have every expectation that our judges can and will follow the law, but with respect, that's not what a rule of civil procedure should do. It shouldn't require our judges to resolve complex questions of constitutional and procedural law with absolutely no guidance. The bill's impact is uncertain. The proponents of the bill cannot predict how many cases this would affect, what the effect would be, or when, if ever, the bill would result in a tangible impact to legal aid. They can't predict what, if any, residual funds will be created, when, what the outcome of the constitutional challenges will be, or a host of other matters. One desired impact that I've heard referenced is to hold wrongdoers accountable, or even to punish wrongdoers. As a general matter, I can't argue with that. But this is a very blunt and, in my view, inappropriate means to pursue that policy objective. A civil class action is a procedural device that allows a large group of people to more easily seek legal relief. If the goal is to punish or to deter, there are well understood and more direct ways of pursuing that objective rather than monkeying with the complex machinery of class action law, including increasing opportunities and the impact of state enforcement or allowing for statutory or punitive damages. Making the bill retroactive is unfair and potentially unlawful. There are many pending cases in which the parties have gone all or part of the way down the road in filing complaints, in settlement negotiations, issuing a notice plan, even litigating a case to verdict. They've done so based on fundamental assumptions about what the law is in Oregon. Pulling the rug out from under those parties without any significant justification and imposing a rare retroactivity provision would be, in my view, unfair. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carol Burnick. I am the partner in charge of the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine. However, this morning I am testifying in opposition to House Bill 4143 on my own behalf. I am not here on behalf of any client. I am not here on behalf of my law firm. I have not discussed my testimony or this bill with any client, and I'm not representing the opinion of any of them. You have heard already from my co-panelists as well as from the prior speakers a lot of information about the language of the bill, its overall fairness and constitutionality. I'm not here to talk about those issues, nor am I here to oppose funding for legal aid. I have been a longtime champion-level contributor to the Campaign for Equal Justice, as has my law firm. Rather, I am testifying in opposition to this bill because of the severe practical impacts I believe it will have on the very persons that class action lawsuits are intended to benefit. I have litigated class actions primarily in the employment setting for the last 15 years, and during the course of my practice, I have represented large, medium, and small companies in those cases. Employment claims are somewhat unique. They involve ongoing personal relationships between the employee and the employer. And because of that, employers always consider the impact of protracted litigation on that relationship. In other words, employers often have a heightened incentive to settle class actions early. Settlement of class actions do not turn those defendants into wrongdoers. I'm sure the state has settled many cases in which they have not believed they were wrongdoers when they settled those cases. Settling cases, there are a lot of reasons why employers will settle class action cases, and they are not always driven by the merits of the case. This bill applies not only to defendants who have been found liable as a result of verdict by a judge or a jury, but for those who choose to try and settle the case. A major consideration that defendants in class actions regularly take into account when discussing settlement is the recognition that no matter what efforts are made, typically by third-party administrators, to find class members, not all of them will be found. And even those that are found will not always participate. Under the current bill, there is no mechanism for a class member to reject a payment on principled reasons. Current or ORCP 32 allows the class member to simply not respond. And we don't know whether they are not responding because it is inconvenient to not respond or because they actually have principled reasons for not wanting to participate. Regardless of the reason for not submitting claim forms, employers are able to put more money into the pockets of those who genuinely believe that they have been aggrieved because the total settlement pot typically takes into consideration the fact that not everyone will file claims. Here's an example. A defendant may be willing to devote $1.5 million to the settlement of a class action, but the employer might put $2 million into the settlement fund, knowing there will be some percentage of people who do not submit claims or cannot be found, and the remainder in the fund that is unclaimed will revert back to it, the employer. The $2 million settlement fund is divided among class members and therefore results in larger settlements for those class members who do submit claims. A defendant in this type of case does nothing to prevent or discourage class members to submit claims. There are many mechanisms in place in which the courts can impose severe sanctions, and they have done this on employers or other defendants who interfere with any class member's opportunity to participate. House Bill 4143 eliminates the feature that permits unclaimed portions of a settlement fund to revert back to the defendant who posted the fund. It therefore deprives defendants of the option to create a settlement fund in excess of what they are actually willing to pay to expand, willing to expend to settle the case, and as a consequence provides less money to the claimants who feel they have been wronged and who submit claim forms. Based on my years of experience, I respectfully submit that this will be a practical consequence of the passage of this bill. Rather than encourage settlements, the bill will discourage them and will result in settlement amounts lower than would otherwise be possible. And I believe more of my clients will take these cases to judgment, resulting in fewer settlements and also resulting in defense verdicts where there is zero recovery to the class. I do not believe this bill is well thought through, and I feel it will hurt the very people it is intended to help. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for your time. I am available to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, J.L. Wilson representing Associated Oregon Industries and the Oregon Manufacturers Association. Just to be clear, the position of the business community is we are, in fact, supportive of the provisions of Section 3 of the bill, which is to say if there are unclaimed funds generated under current procedures, we have no objection to those funds going somewhere else. And, in fact, we have no objection to those funds going to support legal aid. That is our position. What we do not support are the deletions of procedure in Section 1, the inclusion of new language in Section 2, which allows the court to generally describe the class, and we oppose the provisions of Section 5 that make the bill retroactive. What I would conclude with is to say, representing the manufacturers and their concern, not every class action is the consequence of fraud or wrongdoing. The consequence, or I should say, the concern of our members are those who manufacture products arise from things like product design engineering error, product design error, and those consequences in class actions that might ensue from a product that causes damage to the end user. Now, in not all cases is the end user harmed, and the procedures in place allow the court to ascertain who has been harmed, ascertain what damages are owed to those class members, and to aggregate those, and that becomes the award. To allow the court to generally describe the class would, in fact, perhaps reward those who were not harmed by the faulty product or faulty design that wasn't not in fact wrongdoing, and it wasn't indeed it wasn't fraudulent. It was just a mistake on the engineering front. So I just want to impress on the committee that the bill as it's designed could very well inflate awards for claimants who in fact were not harmed, but did in fact purchase a product from one of our members. So I wanted to put that on the record. We do oppose the bill. However, we would support elements of Section 3.
All right. Thank you. Questions? Senator Denborough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So, you know, like many people, I get these mailings fairly often, you know, telling me that I'm part of a class and I'm entitled to $2.30 or whatever. And, you know, I have to say I rarely respond to those. And my assumption all along is that if I don't respond, that money will just be distributed to other people who are also in the class. I'm revealing my ignorance of how the process works. You know, I will say that, you know, I think that most people, just ordinary citizens, don't realize that here in Oregon, if they don't respond, that money goes back to the company. If I knew that, you know, then I might respond differently. Does the communication that goes out to the individual indicate to them that if they don't respond, then the money that they were assessed would go to the company? Some of you who are familiar with this, can you tell me that?
I will say two things. One is, I don't think Oregon is unique in this regard, and again, particularly with respect to settlements. You know, in these cases, the plaintiffs are represented by very competent and experienced lawyers. They know they are evaluating the cases and evaluating the settlement and evaluating the procedure by which notice and claims are being submitted. I cannot recall a notice that I have been involved in which that has been included in the notice, nor can I recall a circumstance where the plaintiff's lawyer has asked that it be included.
Can I follow up?
Yes.
Actually, this is a separate question, but it's also it's to you, Ms. Burnick. So when you're advising a client on a settlement and trying to ascertain a figure, what percent do you assume won't be responding? I mean, what do you tell them in terms of what the, you know, the non-return rate will be?
I'm going to avoid telling you about my attorney-client communications, but I will say this.
Nice try.
I will say this. In the employment context, unlike in some consumer class actions, which I don't do, it is typically a much higher return rate because folks are found much more easily. It can vary depending on the nature of the employer and the case. So if you're dealing with employees who may work at a hospital, typically not a particularly high transient population, easily found. Typically, other kinds of industries, more transient, less able to find. So it will vary between, 5% non-return rate or not being able to be found, to something higher than that, 25% in some industries. I think the return rate, so that's the people who can be found. The return rate is, I think, much higher in employment cases than is true in other cases. And I think those who choose not to respond, in my experience, and this is anecdotal only, it is more often on principled grounds.
And just follow up, and do you have a sense for those that are not employment related, and perhaps some of the other panelists could respond, I'm not going to ask how you advise clients, but how clients in such cases are usually advised, you know, of the assumption of what the non-return rate will be as you're trying to structure that settlement.
Go ahead. Well, Senator Denborough, really stepping off a cliff in the sense that I don't think there's a generic answer at all. If the claim were for a defective product, a pharmaceutical that injured people, the nature of the injury is going to be very serious, probably, and the likelihood that plaintiffs are known would probably be quite high. That in the case of a high-profile case I defended when I was Attorney General on behalf of the state. It was brought by employees of the state system of higher education, which you could trace practically to 100% perfection. And had it resulted in other than a defense verdict, which it did, that would have been very easy to do. In matters involving smaller expenditures and a bigger class, I can't hazard a guess, but my colleague from Stolries may be able to. But I think you understand, Senator Denbro, we're wrestling with something that has many faces.
Chair Przanski, Senator Denbro, I think that's right. It all depends on the context, and certainly take rates vary. I'm not aware of any empirical data, speaking generally, that would necessarily go specifically to what the take rate is, meaning the return rate, people who return claims in one form of action versus another. One of the things I would say, though, and this was the change that I referenced to earlier in 2006, a provision of the current law, which is deleted by House Bill 4143, does say if you, the defendant, have the names and addresses of the class in your own business records and there's no individual determination that's required as to how much those people are owed, then there's kind of an automatic claim procedure that is instituted that basically requires those people to opt out rather than opt in. So in many consumer cases involving, for example, telephone billing or other practices where the defendant does have information about the class, you have a very high return rate.
And can I just ask one more question? Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Mr. Wilson suggested that, you suggested that you're not opposed to the notion of CPRA, though you have problems with some of the ways that this bill is structured. General Frohnmayer, is that true for you as well? I mean, where are you on the major concerns that I heard from you are with the way the bill is structured and it's being introduced in the short session. How about the general notion of CPRA, that is, if people in the class don't respond, that the money would go to a charity or something like legal aid?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Denbro, thank you for asking the question, and I was hoping that someone would, and I think I would have volunteered it if not. You've not heard a whisper of opposition to legal aid and its need. I don't believe in this panel you've heard a whisper of opposition to a CPRA doctrine properly crafted. You have heard opposition, a firestorm of concern from a community that has only gotten late notice about the elimination of constitutionally necessary, in our view, protections for people, both plaintiff and defendant, in class action suits. So we believe that where defendants agreed to the amount of damages to be assessed, or in a case has been fairly and constitutionally adjudicated, a CPRA doctrine not only is appropriate, but could be crafted.
Thank you.
Other questions, comments? Let me just ask regarding the bill itself. From my reading of it, deals with under the RCP Rule 32, sections F, which is entitled Notice and Exclusions, and section L, which is identifying the form of the judgment. So I do not practice in this area. I chose the reason why I do prosecution, and it's not that. So A through E or A through D seems to me to be the area where you're basically determining and establishing what the class is, what the class action is going to be. So could you please give me some better understanding of how the notice section is somehow forming the class. To me, it says we're going to send out to a group of people to give them this information for them to make a decision whether they want to be part of that class action, but it doesn't define the class. And I'm hearing, at least what I thought I heard, is that somehow this is actually changing how we determine what the class or who the class will be.
Senator Przanski, members of the committee, others may have a better answer than this, but I think the direct answer is that it broadens and makes more vague the articulation of who constitutes the class. That's the introduction of the new words, giving the judge the authority to using this new world generally describe the class, as opposed to the procedures right now that we believe are the articulation of, in fact, minimum due process notice requirements that are now being deleted. So if you can't determine exactly who's in the class, you don't know exactly what the damages are, and that creates a cloud of, in our view, constitutionally relevant uncertainty. If these class action measures were left unchanged, or at least in, as a matter of prudence, deferred to the council and court procedures to give its considered judgment, as these experts always do, that would substantially reduce our concern. But it's the articulation of new language, the deletion of existing protections, the lack of a reason why these changes are being made that leaves it so troubling, coupled with a retroactivity provision that leaves uncertain the nature and number and dimension of the interests that are being affected with this legislation that possesses not only retroactivity but an emergency clause.
Okay. So let me ask, because my reading of, again, of these initial sections, in determining the class, it does take the judge to say yes or no, this is going to be the class. Is that correct or is that wrong? Plaintiff
Chair.
Doesn't decide this. Defendant doesn't decide it. The court does, meaning the judge.
Chair Przanski, the court does certify a class. And the class is certified as, it will have a definition, for example, all purchasers of a particular product between X date and Y date. That's what happens at the certification stage. And a notice is issued to that general group of people that allows them the opportunity to opt out if they so choose and gives them some information about the case. But under current law, the actual members of the class, who is going to be listed in the judgment, who's required to be listed in the judgment, are those people that after a dispositive verdict is rendered or there's another decision, have returned the claim forms. Those people have decided, yes, I'm aware of this class, I wish to seek compensation, and they are identified in the judgment as class members. Those provisions are deleted. Instead, the court can just generally say in the judgment, the class is all purchasers between X date and Y date, no matter whether or not they wish to seek compensation or not, no matter whether there's a claim form process or not. And I frankly don't know what generally described means, if it means what class has been certified or some other description that the court would decide is sufficient. So that's where the class definition problem comes in.
I have one other one. We've heard testimony, and no one on this panel has refuted it, that this issue has in fact gone to the council on court rules and procedures, and they have basically punted back to us as the legislative body to make a determination. If that's the case, why would we send it back to them? Are you saying we should come up with some form, whatever that process is, and then send it to them to have their blessing or their approval before we actually pass the legislation?
Senator Przanski, members of the committee, with all due respect, Mr. Chair, I don't think that's exactly the case. I cannot represent to you because I do not know precisely the language considered by the Council on Court Procedures in prior years. I do suggest to you that it probably has not considered legislation or proposed rule changes that also are retroactive. Because that language was added in the A. Engrossed version. I know that two members of this committee are co-sponsors of the bill. That language was added after you agreed to allow your names to accompany this bill. So my guess is, without having verified it, Senator, that the impact of a retroactivity clause on a rule change on pending litigation has not been considered by the council, and I do not know whether what it has considered in what might be called a fluid class recovery mechanism that this may be trying to emulate. I do not know whether that's the same language. So the fact that it's not been refuted by this panel doesn't mean that it's even been examined by this panel.
Well, I'm not saying the specifics as the generality that apparently this was given to them and they've come back. At least the testimony tells us that we, the legislature, need to set the policy.
Chair Przanski, if I could address that briefly. The council has previously taken the position that a CyPRAE provision is a legislative determination. However, the changes that are reflected in Section 1, the elimination of the procedures and the claim form procedures, have been the subject of vigorous debate within the Council at regular intervals, most recently in 2006. So I'm not sure what communications were made to the Council or not, and on what topics, but circumstantial evidence suggests to me that the Council believes that a CyPRAE provision is a legislative determination, but class action procedure is within its ambit.
Okay, thank you. Senator Robel.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. I guess I just want to go back to the comment that you made with regard to the class and the definition. So there's an initial recommendation that here's the class. And as my understanding, that's the class upon which they base the individual amount payment for all people. Then we have the information sent out, and we get a group back that respond. And they get their portion of that larger amount because they responded. And so what you're telling me is that once that happens, there's a new class developed, made up of only those people who responded. So the original class that the court was deciding the payment on, this larger class, is now reduced to this new claimant. And so in that case, if that is the new class, they would be paid. Any checks that were returned would be the only amount left to be distributed, because the other half of the class, or whatever it was, is no longer part of the class. Am I understanding this right? So CyPRAE would be, you can give them back the 10 checks that came back unresponded, but you can't give any more of this other money that was adjudicated or agreed to in the first case. Is that correct?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Roblin, let me try to answer the question by maybe reformulating a little bit and see if I can do that. The class is certified, and typically there's an adjudication of liability, but not a determination of how much damage the defendant will ultimately owe, because that needs to be determined in the subsequent claim form procedure. You may know that there's a set amount per person, or there may need to be individual determinations of how those damages are to be assessed. A product may harm one person $5,000 and the other one $2,000. The court needs to sort that out under current procedure by adjudicating those claims. It's at the end of that process that you define who is entitled to compensation, who's made the claims to compensation, and how much they are owed. That's when you have a fully litigated case. Now, there may be other circumstances where the defendant, to settle the case, says, I'm going to settle this case for $5 million, and everybody who's entitled to some of that money, come make a claim. And a bunch of people make claims, but there's a leftover pot. That's a circumstance where you do have an excess money, a residual amount, and the court or the legislature needs to determine how that is distributed.
Hold on. But in general, what we're saying is there really wouldn't be any CyPRAE, whatever you want to say it, money left over if the class is narrowed down at the end to just those people who responded. Because all of that other that was in the adjudication who the jury may have found to have been harmed, because they didn't respond, their harm is given back to the company. Is that correct? So if we don't change the definition in this section, there really won't be any a substantial money that was owed to the general class. It would only be to this new defined class. Is that correct?
Under current law, the procedure is that the defendant's liability is determined by the people who either submit the claim forms or who are deemed to have submitted the claim forms, because we know who they are, okay, and there's no individual adjudications.
Okay. Thanks.
Any other questions?
I do, Member Alton. Mr. Chair, on this issue of retroactivity, has Legislative Council weighed in on that?
They're here. We're going to have them come up after the next panel.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
We appreciate your time. Our next panel is going to include Travis Prescott, Lane Shutterly, Lewis Pitt, and Megan Kovacs. Thank you.
guess I'll speak first. Chair Porzanski, members of the committee, I'm Travis Prestwich. I'm a lawyer practicing here in Salem and have a small business in doing so. But additionally, I'm a member of the Oregon State Bar's Board of Governors, and I'm here on behalf of the bar today to testify in support of House Bill 4143. I thank you for your work and your time in considering this important legislation. Before I begin my prepared comments, I'd like to just address a couple of the issues that have come up over the course of this morning's testimony. There's been a lot stated about the Council on Court Procedures. As has been noted by the chair, this particular piece of legislation is a substantive issue. The Council on Court Procedures is only tasked with and has authority to deal with procedural matters. And so because of that, the Council has returned this type of legislation back to, or changes, I should say, back to the legislature to deal with because it's substantive in nature. There's been some reference to this. This change will be like a grenade. With all due respect to Mr. Frohnmayer, as part of my testimony, we've had our experts prepare a flow chart that's included in my testimony that talks and shows what the current law is under class actions in Oregon and then what those changes would be. And I excuse my notes here at the bottom, but if you were to reference and look at that flow chart, the only changes that take place are in the bottom right-hand corner, and that's just with respect to the claims process. And so because of that, the due process protections remain in place. The size of the, or excuse me, the procedures for determining the class remain in place. The only changes that are made are the determinations of the monies and the distribution through the claims process. There's been testimony to the effect of that this is an unexpected or unanticipated outcome, that it is a dramatic change in law. Certainly it's a change in Oregon's law, but as has been noted previously, 48 other states have a law like this in place. It is not retroactive despite the testimony that we've heard here today. It only applies to cases in which there's been no judgment yet rendered. Those cases are not settled and looks prospectively to cases in the future. There's also been some question about a pharmaceutical case or class actions involving pharmaceutical cases. Those cases are preempted by federal law and are handled in the federal system as opposed to being allowed to be brought here. So you could not bring a pharmaceutical case in Oregon under state law. And the changes that are made in the bill with reference to identifying the class are changes that are necessary to allow those monies to ultimately, if unclaimed, to go to legal aid or some other source as opposed to going back to the defendant who's been adjudicated to be responsible for those losses. Now, returning to my comments, our written comments, it is the Oregon State Bar's highest priority access to justice. This includes not only ensuring adequate court funding, but also ensuring adequate funding for low-income legal services, both on the criminal side and civil side of cases. House Bill 4143 is one important tool that we can use to help address civil legal needs for low-income Oregonians. Under the statutory and regulatory structure still in place today, that were developed under the leadership of Senator Neil Bryant, who was then the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, the Oregon State Bar was assigned by statute to provide standards, guidelines, evaluation, oversight, and enforcement for legal aid services. State funding is sent to the Oregon State Bar and distributed to the nonprofit corporations that provide services to these clients. The Bar, as an independent regulatory agency, was assigned this responsibility because it understands the regulation of lawyers engaged in the practice of law. Legal aid plays an integral part in keeping Oregon's courts running efficiently. A legal aid attorney can help a family to stay in their home, can deal with issues of domestic violence, like getting a restraining order, can help a taxpayer negotiate a resolution to their case, done more efficiently and with fewer missteps. So this not only ensures that they get the assistance that they need, but allows our court systems to run smoothly, and it provides economic benefit for Oregon. As I testified previously on the House side when this bill came forward, our courts are filled with people who are trying to represent themselves and don't have the education, the experience, and the ability to do so. They need the assistance of legal aid attorneys to help them through that process. Before 2011, legal aid services received state funding by way of a dedicated surcharge, as the Attorney General commented. But now that state funding process has been modified, in which the legal aid services now receives $11.9 million per biennium through a direct distribution from the general fund in the account of the Judicial Department. Currently, there are approximately 80 different sources for funding legal aid. Due to a variety of economic and political pressures, including the after effects of the 2008 economic crisis, current funding from non-legislative sources has suffered dramatically. For example, federal funds have been decreased by $800,000 between 2011 and 2012. Another important source is the interest on lawyer trust accounts. Due to lower interest rates, those funds have dropped from their high in 2007 of $3.6 million to a current amount of approximately $1 million in 2013, and they expect an additional decrease of approximately $160,000 this year. As at the same time that we are have less funds for legal aid, the need for legal aid services has increased. Between 2000 and 2011, legal aid eligible population in Oregon has increased by 61.5%. National standards indicate that we should have, at a minimum, two legal aid lawyers for every 10,000 low-income citizens. Currently, Oregon meets half of that need. We have 850,000 Oregonians that meet the income qualifications for legal assistance. The bar is working and will continue to work with representatives from all three branches of government, with legal aid programs, with the Campaign for Equal Justice, the Oregon Law Foundation, and Oregon foundations and corporations through the Task Force on Legal Aid to identify and capitalize on new funding whenever possible. I submit that House Bill 4143 is one unique opportunity that we have, that you have, to move legal aid funding in the right direction. I thank you for your consideration, and I'm happy to answer any questions at the conclusion of the testimony.
All right, we're going to take the rest of the testimony. I do want to just say, remind the panelists that I don't think there's an issue here regarding where the money may be going in the sense of the need for legal aid and such. I think it's more the technical perspectives of us making the changes that would actually create in this state the CyPRAE system.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Lane Shetterly. I'm here today in a couple of capacities, one as a private practicing attorney in Dallas, also as a member of the board of directors of the Legal Aid Services of Oregon and Oregon Law Center. And also as a former legislator with a passion for supporting legal aid. And I appreciate the testimony even of the opponents of the bill today, recognizing the need for legal aid funding to support the services that it provides. And, Mr. Chair, as you noted, since that seems to be generally recognized, I won't dwell on that. You also have my written testimony that addresses this. I just want to touch on a couple of points. One, this issue of changes with regard to procedure relative to class actions. And the role of the Council on Court Procedures. I think Mr. Prestwich touched on it, and I think Senator Roblin did in his earlier questions, that the changes that you see in the bill relative to the procedures really are necessary to get to what constitutes an identifiable unclaimed fund. That's really what that's about. So there is a procedural element to that, but I say that it's really more mechanical and directed to the substance of the bill, which is to create and to be able to establish what is an identified fund from which then this residue can be drawn and paid over to support legal aid. So it's not purely procedural. It touches procedure, but the purpose of it is to affect the substance of the bill. And I think I'm glad to hear the Legislative Council is here and can probably do a better job than I can in addressing that, but this isn't just getting in and playing with procedures relative to class actions. It is all designed to make Section 3, which is the heart of the bill, work. And the other thing I would just add in my own testimony with regard to constitutionality, I feel like I want to apply for some CLE credits based on the...
I think we will be.
Yeah. Based on the testimony we have heard and probably will hear, I will give you the disclaimer. I am not a constitutional lawyer. I'm a country lawyer. But I enjoy hearing the testimony, and I can follow most of it. What I would say from my humble perspective of this is... you'll be hearing from your lawyer after us, legislative counsel. I understand legislative counsel has rendered an opinion as to the constitutionality. And in my world, where you have disputes among lawyers, and lawyers are paid to dispute, and lawyers love to dispute even if they're not paid, and so I'm not surprised that we have good arguments on both sides of this from highly qualified people. My situation is tells me that when you have a lawyer and you pay your lawyer, you follow your lawyer's advice. That's the safest course for you. Your lawyer is looking out for your interest to advise you. So I understand that this is a learned committee, probably not up to determining complex questions of constitutional law this morning. Courts are there for that. You have a lawyer to advise you, and my sense is, and my advice to you would be to follow your lawyer's advice on the issue of constitutionality. Mr. Chair, I thank you for the thorough consideration you're giving this bill. It's a bill that had it occurred to me as a member to pass this or to bring it before the committee I chaired on the House side, I would have endorsed this without reservation, and I urge you to as well.
Thank you. So, Megan or Lewis, who would like to go next?
I can go next.
Okay.
Hi, Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee. My name is Megan Kovacs. I'm the education coordinator at Raphael House of Portland, and I don't think that I need to speak to any of you about the benefit of legal aid services, but I do represent and work with a number of survivors of domestic violence who are impacted by the services that legal aid provides. So I'm going to keep this very brief and just talk about the benefit that legal aid gives to survivors who oftentimes have had their voice taken away, and legal aid provides a service that gives survivors of violence their voice back. We know that many survivors of domestic and sexual violence have systematically had their voice taken away, and thus also their access to people, system, safety, and even sometimes their belief that they deserve to have a voice. And legal aid provides a service that allows people to have access to speaking the language of the law. People who typically don't understand or couldn't work within the system, where maybe the system is very frustrating or difficult to understand and to advocate for oneself within, legal aid gives people the ability to have a voice within that system, to have access to services, and survivors oftentimes need to access a variety of civil legal services, from child custody cases to divorce cases to cases with landlords, after having been displaced from homes, from jobs, from schools, from the support network that they hold very dear and that they need, legal aid provides a resource for survivors of violence to access those systems again, to have a voice within those systems. So I want to offer my support I want to offer my support of House Bill 4143, speaking for the very people that the increase in legal aid services and the impact of that will have on domestic violence survivors. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Louis Pitt, Jr., Warm Springs Confederated Tribes. I'm a governmental liaison. Apologies about not getting a letter to you. We've been scrambling to try to get our leadership, our legislative leadership, and also known as Tribal Council, to focus in on this, I think, opportunity for us to help ourselves as a tribal people. I think here we're talking about the how are we going to do it. I'd just like to say a little bit about the who and why. And there's roughly about 40,000 tribal people in the state of Oregon. 5,000 of those are tribal members at Warm Springs. And most of those folks do live on the reservation, and we do have services there to help them with many of their quests in trying to carry out their tribal way of life and their Oregonian way of life. And but we also, as a tribe, have limited means. And so it's great that one of the, I think, the great offers that Oregon has is low-priced, if not pro bono, legal assistance, legal aid. An office up in Bend, Oregon, is that they come down to the reservation. We have a contract with them to help work with our folks. That every week I get three, four, five inquiries about at the post office, and somebody hits me up with, hey, I got this situation going, what can I do? And, well, you can call the tribal office, or here's the number for legal aid up in Bend, and then let them know when they're meeting with us down there on the reservation. So with the WHO that we have is, you know, it's tribal members off reservation. There's 40,000-plus tribal people in the state of Oregon, and there's 9 federally recognized tribes, but most of us, again, on criminal type of situations, is that for some reason in America, we are probably the most victimized people of anybody as far as major crimes go, violent crimes against tribal people. And I think the same is true. We have an easy target on us that says we're fair game, and so we really need the assistance of the of wherever we can get it with legal aid. The why, give you an example. Jefferson County is 1 in 4 people are on food stamps. Our unemployment on reservation is 60+%. I just saw a report from the Burns Paiute tribe that had them at 58.5% unemployment. Not to speak for the Burns tribe, it's just a report that I did see. And I think all of the on-reservation tribes are in a similar situation, is that tribal people do wish to remain tribal. And all respect to the state of Oregon's way of life, we have our own way of life. The why, of course, is very much is that, you know, we believe in the American dream, too, the due process, and to be our way of life being respected, and our family way of life is, my dad always taught me to, you know, that the why is is to live your tribal way of life, your Indian way of life, or your family way of life, and the means is to figure out how to use your governments. I feel like I'm peeking into the internal affairs of the state of Oregon, but I'm, you know, I commend, I think, the transparency here to be able to, as a tribal person, to speak before you. We've got a long record as tribal people with both the Native American protection on legal services and the Oregon legal aid. I've been involved with trying to procure legal aid on Warm Springs Reservation for us little guys. I was a little guy at one time on the reservation. Now I can put my suit on and put my bow tie on and come in here and talk for a whole people. At one time, I just spoke for myself. And how do we get protections against even our own tribe? Well, I have to figure all that out. And so now I'm here to say that, you know, the Naples and legal aid, they've helped, I think, restoration of the Western tribes, tribes that were unfairly terminated, just terminated. You're no longer an Indian. And they stepped up to give a lot of pro bono work, and we helped as Warm Springs tribes, as a non-terminated tribe, to work with a number of friends of the Western tribes to help get them their status back as Indian people. I love being an Indian person. I thank the Creator every morning I wake up and said, yay, I'm still an Indian today. So. And again, I was always wondering in college, is that, you know, why are we reading this Don Quixote in their Cervantes, the haves and have-nots? And to me, it's just kind of, I get mad about it. It sounds like the haves want to keep something that isn't even theirs. So anyway, and I thank you, Senator. I heard you, Chairman, I heard you say that you're working on the technical part of this. I hope I've added to your information and knowledge about why for tribal people, and we have a lot of poor people in Oregon. Poverty is one of those things we're not supposed to talk about, I guess, and homelessness and all that, but it's a very big reality, and as tribal people, we'll do our damnedest on reservation to take care of our folks, and we know the reality is we have to partner and collaborate and cooperate with folks around us to really get a full package of what it is to really protect our way of life. So, again, I thank you, committee, and thank you for the transparency that you have, and we definitely support House Bill 4143 for what it can do to, I think, some of the invisible people and unheard people in our state of Oregon.
Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Close?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Preswich, I'm a little concerned also that 38 lines of very small print have been removed from the ORCP. I'd like to ask you specifically two questions in Section 2. It says that the judgment in this action, this is the new language, must generally describe the members of the class and must specify and identify any persons who requested exclusion. Previously it said that shall specify or describe those found to be members of the class or who, as a condition of exclusion, have agreed to be bound by the judgment. First question, legally, in your opinion, what do the words generally describe? What does that mean legally?
Chair Prozanski, Senator Close, I'm not sure that I'm the best person to comment on what this specifically is defined as, and I will defer any more explicit answer to legislative counsel. It's my understanding that the changes for the definition of the class are only changes necessary to allow unclaimed funds at the end of the process to be given back to the state and ultimately to legal aid, as this bill intends to do. It doesn't make any changes with respect to those persons that have the wrongs committed against them, okay, for lack of a better phrase. It doesn't change those necessary elements to allow them to participate in the class. It wouldn't expand those class members in any sense of the word. They still have to be the person that is in need of repair to have the issue fixed.
Okay, thank you. And then this specifically identify any persons who requested exclusion from the class. Seems to me that would be almost impossible to specifically identify any persons who didn't want to be included across what, the whole country, the whole world. What does that mean then? Can that actually be done?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Close, again, deferring to legislative counsel on a more expansive answer, but it's my understanding that language is necessary to allow for the funds to be deferred to the unclaimed portion of those funds to be deferred through this CyPRE doctrine to legal aid or some other source if that were the case. But it does not expand the class. It does not change the necessary requirements an individual would need to have in order to qualify. Those changes, as listed in our flow chart, there's nothing changed in that initial process to identify potential class members and to create the class as it goes forward. The only changes that happen are on the back end.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Our next panel is going to include President Courtney and Marissa James, if you'll please come up. While they're coming up, I have no one else that's scheduled to give testimony as written down. Is there anyone else who wanted to that did not sign up? I think what we'll do is start with President Courtney, and then we'll field any other questions, technical questions for counsel.
Well, Well, my name is Peter Courtney, and I'm a state senator, District 8, which is portions of Salem, as well as Jervis and Woodburn. You know, Senator Brzezinski, you sure know how to draw a crowd. I was going to testify on this bill in the House, and I walked through those doors, and then I walked back out. And there are people sitting behind me that I like and respect very much. I've been concerned when they've had some heartbreak problems, they know that. But this reminds me of another issue years ago on health care. I want to testify on this bill. It's not about the President of the Senate. I am a state senator, but I want to testify on the bill. I very much support this bill. I love this state, and I've always said that Oregon likes to be first of only. It's a phrase I invented years ago. The first state to do things that nobody else does, the only state to do something nobody else does. But this is an example of something I would like to say, as much as I love the state of New Hampshire, because I do think it's a great state, not because it produced Chip Kelly, but because it's part of New England, and I very much identify with New England and the great people there. This is one of the first or only lists I like to get off of. Clearly what the bill does is basically says that, just an example as I have it here, listed in my testimony, if you have $1 million to 50,000 class members or $20 per person, under current law, if any of the class members do not fill out the papers, the money goes back to the defendant. Just to remedy this, by the Cypre Doctrine, which I understand comes from French, which basically means as near as possible, or as near as may be. Now, we cannot force each member of a class to claim their damage. This doctrine would allow the unclaimed awards to go to the next best option. It proposes the state direct the money to our legal aid system. Now, that is why I've come. They say, once a Marine, always a Marine. And that's another part of my life I won't get into because I tried to be a Marine officer. Once a legal aid attorney, always a legal aid attorney. I was a legal aid attorney. And right up the street here, the whole wall office, we labored, five of us, for several years, because legal aid attorneys in some states, you're only allowed to be a legal aid attorney so long, then they make you move because you burn out. And I remember so many times, there was one day I saw 29 clients and I collapsed. The services they provide, which have been documented, abused women, senior citizens, people being evicted, affordable housing, debtor collector, medical bills, I could go on and on. And what is interesting, my relationships with the business community were extraordinary. With a single phone call, we could take a person that was destitute, that was so far down, they had no hope in life, and give them a chance. We didn't go necessarily into court, don't make any, no doubt about it. We were the warriors, we are the Marines, in my opinion, although they are another legal system. But we saw our role is giving a judicial system to people in our society that simply do not have it. We are a nation of laws and a constitution, but the sad point is we're not all created equal. We don't all have the same kind of resources. And this bill is about that. Somewhere in my legislative career, there comes a time, because I've voted on so many things, with some bills it's become the bottom line. And the only reason I'm here is this has become a bottom line bill for me. The compelling argument to make sure that all our Oregonians have access to our extraordinary legal system, our courts, our judges, our attorneys, the way we live here in this greatest state, is very, very compelling, and that is what's at stake in this bill. Now, I'm really torn apart by this bill because the state bar is involved. There are judges. They're met with me on the second floor of Willamette University months ago to say we've got to find and help legal aid in our society. All walks of life and attorneys were there. Successful attorneys, powerful attorneys, judges, because there is in the heart of Oregon, they do not want those that don't have the resources not to go out with legal representation. This bill attempts to try to do something about it. We have struggled on this issue for years. We've struggled on this issue on legal aid funding and on this doctrine. And so I have no illusions about where I am and what's going on. I just wish there was a way we could understand that the bottom line is so compelling that we are going to make this happen, because it is what Oregon does when she's faced with these kind of things. If you could have seen, and I'm not trying to play emotions with you, if you could have seen what it's like to have a client come into your office with their children and their wife lost, they're going to be kicked out of their apartment, there's no heat, you could have seen it. You've all been there. You all care deeply about people, every one of you. Everybody in this room does. Every one of you cares deeply. And you could see after they left my office, I'm not a great attorney. No, that's not what we're talking about here. Because we were able, in that short time, to say, we're going to keep you in your place. You'll be able to stay in that apartment. I made a phone call. But you got to know, we got to have set up a payment schedule, you know, etc. If you could have seen how it transformed their lives, you would understand the magnitude of what we're talking about, because everything we do eventually goes out in the streets. I know there's extraordinary legal minds in this room, extraordinary legal minds not in this room, that are struggling over this. Extraordinary business interests in this room, very successful people in this room, not. But in the end, we're talking about individuals whose everyday life is a struggle beyond description. In our system, which is a fair system, this is about that. So, you know, I wasn't going to come here today, and you saw where I half read my testimony, but more or less I spoke from other experiences. I don't know if you can get there, Senator Brzezinski. I don't know if the committee can get there. But I can tell you that this is so Oregon. This is what we don't let people suffer in our state if we can help it. We don't. We're not built that way. Everything we've tried to do in healthcare, I know it makes people mad me say that, everything is to try to deal with suffering, to make sure that those who suffer don't suffer. And I don't want to be melodramatic here. I'm not passing any judgment. I would not be here talking like this if this hasn't caught me and hit me pretty hard. So I really thank you, Chair Brzezinski, for even letting me come in this late and making these statements. I thank every member of the committee for allowing me to make these kinds of statements, somewhat personal, but very heartfelt, as a human being, as a lawyer, but also as an Oregonian, as a public policymaker.
Thank you. So what we're going to do is open up for questions, either for the president or for counsel. Marissa James is the author of the letter that was attached to the documents for part of the public record regarding the constitutionality of the bill. I do know that some members had some questions. I would let those members go ahead and re-ask those questions if you'd like. So, Senator Close, we'll start with you, and then Senator Dimbrough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was, in Section 2, the bold-faced lines there must generally describe, this is the judgment, must generally describe the members of the class. And that was the first question. That phrase, I'd like to know legally, if it's used legally, if a judge sees that, what are his instructions there? It seems so vague.
Chair Pruzanski, Senator Close, Marisa James, Deputy Legislative Counsel. So I'm not sure that word generally adds so much to the word describe. Really, what we're asking the judge there to do is to describe the members of the class. I think one of the other testifiers today gave an example of people who purchased a product between January 2012 and January 2014. I think that's what we're looking for in that phrase. It's not really that different from what we had before, which said that the judgment should specify or describe those found to be members of the class.
And then the second part of that, because you've got a very general term there, and then the rest of the line says, must specifically identify any person who requested exclusion. Specifically identify any person. That's very specific.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering, because people don't respond, and I've done it myself, to postcards that come in the mail for, you know, 63-cent judgment or whatever it is. You know, they're very small, the ones I've seen. If they can't identify those persons, then what happens? Because you've got must specify.
So, Chair Pruzanski, Senator Close, I think if you look back at the portion of RCP 32F that remains in F1, the notice that goes out to all of the potential class members is going to provide a mechanism for excluding yourself from the class. So if you don't want to be part of the class from the beginning, you will send some kind of postcard or a letter, or it might even be an email today. I don't know how, you know, maybe things work differently now. But you will have proactively excluded yourself from the class, and those are the people who will be specifically listed under that provision.
Okay. I understand. Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Close?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Senator Dimbrough?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask you, Ms. James, about the retroactivity issue.
Mm-hmm.
But before we get to that, just following up on Senator Close, and the, you know, we heard a comment from a previous testifier that the changes here were made in order to implement a CPRA methodology into our class action suits. Do the deletions and additions do more than that, in your opinion?
Chair Pruzanski, Senator Dimbrough. So the portions that are deleted here are a very specific directions about how a judgment has to work in a class action. The federal rules and most of the other state statutes that I've looked at don't have that level of detail at all. As I believe Senator Roblin pointed out with his question, you won't have a lot of unclaimed damages under this scheme because the damages are limited to the people who write in for their damages. So yes, the deletions are necessary. However, the judge could determined to go through the to use this procedure that's in the law currently and do the claim letter procedure if the judge chooses under even under the new more flexible provision. Does that answer your question?
I think so. So there's nothing in this that prohibits the judge from you know, following a methodology that we've heard many people support.
That's right.
Okay, thank you. So the issue of retroactivity, so, you know, the charge is that retroactivity, the retroactivity provision that was added to this bill would have a really substantial, I think, would have a substantial impact on cases that are in process right now. Is that what was intended in this edition, or how do you read that?
Senator Pruzanski, Senator Dimbrough, I don't really know what the intention of it is. It's a policy decision how the applicability clause works. However, we always worry about birds in flight in legislative drafting. So, you know, birds that have already taken off, we don't want to change their trajectory in the middle of their flight and cause unintended consequences. So I did think about that in drafting this, and so the people where you could have the most impact here is like cases maybe where the claim form procedure has already started. So, you know, the judgment hasn't been entered, but the claim forms have started coming in. So the judge in that case could certainly just proceed with that procedure, and nothing would have to be changed. So it will only impact pending cases in which a judgment hasn't been entered, and those cases could proceed just as they are.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you. I just want to do one short clarification from a question that was just asked by Senator Dembro. Currently, at the beginning of a proceeding, as was mentioned before, a judge has to make a determination as to a class. So it could say it was a particular device that was being sold between this date and that date, and anyone who bought that device between those two dates becomes the class that the proceedings will deal with. And that's a general description. So that could be the class that now is identified in the Section 2. Would more likely be the class.
Senator Przanski, Senator Roblin, I think that's exactly right. And that's the notice that would go out to all of those people who are generally described when the class is established in the first place.
Hold up.
You may.
And currently, if we left the procedures that are in place, the class that starts out that size and for which the hearings take place and to which many of the judgments describe that number of people who were identified times a certain amount gives you the total amount of the judgment. And that in our current situation that most places don't do, there is another process that takes place that redescribes the class and narrows it from that general description down to just those who return the forms.
Senator Przanski, Senator Roblin, I don't know if it redescribes the class, but that is exactly what happens. There is a larger class, and then damages are eventually distributed to a smaller group, a subgroup of that class.
And for the purpose of the distribution of resources, it's just that new class that gets any money, and the rest is determined not to be in that class and goes back. And therefore, if we didn't define it, there would be nothing left over except return checks to be put into a CPRE.
Senator Przanski, Senator Roblin, right. So there might be people who died or who, you know, moved, or, you know, there could be small amounts of unclaimed damages, but you're right, there would not be a significant amount.
Thank you.
Yeah, Marissa, there was just something. I'm a little confused now because you said we do this change and a judge could use, if he chose current methodology, what's in statute now. So does that mean that the judge can invent his own methodology for how he's doing it? How could he use methodology that's no longer in statute?
Senator Przanski, Senator Cruz, so the bill provides a lot more flexibility. It just says that the court may approve a process for the payment of damages. The court could choose to approve the process that's in statute now, or the court could choose a different process, although that process would have to comply with all constitutional requirements. Due process would have to provide adequate notice to the class of everything that goes on.
On discretion. Any other questions or comments? Senator Close?
One more technicality. So we're taking out people who have agreed to be bound by the judgment and changing that to those who request exclusion. So I think there's a big difference there. So which would be the bigger class, in your opinion, between what was in the former writing and what you've put in there now, where they have to request it?
Senator Przanski, Senator Close, I'm not sure what would be the bigger class. So the difference here are people who the judge might say, if you want to exclude yourself, you can't come and bring an individual suit later. If you want to exclude yourself on, you know, because you don't like class actions or you don't think you were wronged, then you have to relinquish your claims and not bring a claim later. The judge could also allow people to bring individual claims. So I don't know. I think it would depend on the case.
Isn't basically what I'm understanding is that you set the class, and that can be if you're using the date certains of anyone that bought a item between certain dates, that would be the mass of the size of the class. And I mean, that's not going to change under what we have here. What's going to change is what Senator Roblin has been focusing on, is that at the point of where in Oregon law, the way I understand it, is that at some point there's going to be a determination as to how many people have responded
who actually want to be included within that class, others who have chosen to be excluded, or those who have not responded. But those who actually are under current law included because they have filed the form, the claim, they are then going to get some portion of the money that has been awarded through a judgment or through a settlement. And it's not going to per se change as to the amount they're getting based on the number of people who, let's say, included themselves into that class. And so that's where you get to the point of where you're going to more than likely have residual funds that are not going to be awarded across, that would in fact either go back under current law to the defendant or defendants, or under this new policy would go into the CyPRE, wherever that's.
Senator Prezansky, I think that's right, yeah.
All right. Any other questions, any comments? I want to thank everyone for coming forward today. This has been very informative, and as someone had said, you know, half-naturally, maybe we should put in for CLE credits, so you may want to leave your bar numbers at the door if you're here. Thank you very much. Now, what we're going to do is I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 4143A. We are scheduled to meet next Tuesday. I know that we don't have to do this, but I am going to go through this just to take care of my little paranoias. We are carried over, and more than likely we'll be posting separately House Bill 4026A, House Bill 4035A, as well as House Bill 4103A, and the one we just concluded, House Bill 4143A. And if I missed any, we'll still post it.
Okay.
With that, thank you very much, and we're adjourned. Adjourned.